This is the State of Things from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio. Emilio Vicente never thought his race for student body president would garner national attention. He said he ran because he wanted to give a voice to the voiceless at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. But being an undocumented gay Latino student in the South did turn a lot of heads. Emilio lost the election to Andrew Powell, but he is still committed to making UNC Chapel Hill a safer place for the underrepresented, and he is my guest today. Emilio Vicente, welcome to the State. It's good to have you here.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me. I look forward to our conversation.
Well, it's going to start right now with the very first question. Sure. Why did you decide to run?
Yeah, so I decided to run for student body president because I've loved my experience at UNC. I've had an amazing experience. I've met so many different students from across campus, with different unique experiences. And that made me realize that my experience itself was also different. And I wanted to make sure that students on campus had a voice and that we hear more from students and not just about students. And that's the main emphasis of my platform, of to engage, to address any of the most pressing issues that our university faces, including sexual assault. We need to engage the students most directly impacted. We need to hear from them, not just about them. And so that was my emphasis for my platform. And I thought that throughout my experiences at UNC, I could do that if I was elected student body president.
Well, tell me more about your experience. Did you feel underrepresented? Did you feel that somehow your voice and your experience weren't getting through?
Yeah. I mean, I think UNC is an inclusive and welcoming community. In some cases, a lot of groups work in a silo. All of us do amazing work, but unfortunately, there isn't someone who brings us all together and see that a lot of our work overlaps. And so that's the experience that I felt, and as well as some of my team members felt that same way, that there wasn't much representation of students in student government. And again, I wanted to change that. I think it's sometimes good to have an outsider come in and change the organization. We have a new chancellor who has no connection to UNC previous to being appointed chancellor. And so I saw this, I mean, she's an amazing person, and I saw this as a way to compensate for that as well at the UNC level, student level.
What would that representation mean? I mean, what is it that for, and you can represent, if you want, a number of groups who might be underrepresented, LGBT, Latino, and undocumented. What do you think being a representative would mean for them? What's not happening now or is happening for those students that you think should change and might change if they had a better voice?
Yeah, no, that's a really good question. So my emphasis for running wasn't that I had these three different identities and that I was going to run on these. These are identities that have shaped a lot of my experiences at UNC and just overall my life experiences. But I do think that those experiences align with the way that some students feel on campus, that they didn't have a voice, don't have a voice. And I definitely look forward to working with Andrew Powell and any other student to ensure that those students that have felt underrepresented are represented at the student level, as well as when we're talking with administrators, other key stakeholders on and off campus. Had I won, I would have done I would have done massive outreach to ensure that all of these students, regardless of identities, I wouldn't have just focused with underrepresented communities, but just overall any student on campus who wants to be part of student government and who wants to be part of change. Again, I think that when we make students realize that they have a stake and that their voices matter in the issues that affect us all across campus, it's something, you know, really good when they feel that, you know, they're part of something bigger.
Tell me about the campaign itself and what you've learned along the way. What was it like when you announced? What kind of support did you get?
Yeah, no, it's been an amazing experience. Again, I never thought that I was going to receive this much attention, but I've been really impressed. I've met amazing students doing great work across campus. I've met students that I would have never wise either talked to or ever really connected with. It's definitely an intense process of assembling a team, of ensuring that your ideas and values align with what you want to see. And I think there's so much pressure from across campus to ensure that you are as well qualified as possible. But overall, it was an amazing experience. If you had told me 3 years ago that I was going to be running for student body president, I probably would have told you that you're out of your mind. But right now, I enjoyed every second of it. I learned so much from the students that I met, I was really impressed with my personal team. I had a team of around 20 students, and they definitely made sure that I was as competitive as possible. And I know that if it wasn't for all of them, I wouldn't have made it this far. And for that, I'm really thankful.
What were you thinking 3 years ago when you entered UNC? What were your intentions? What were your plans at the time?
Yeah. So before I started at UNC, I took a gap year. I took a year off and I did immigration advocacy in D.C. For half of my gap year. And so when I came back to UNC, started my first year at UNC, my goal was I want to change the way that immigrants are talked about in the state, especially just overall the sentiment. And I saw UNC as a great way of doing that. And so I became really involved my first year leading Students United for Immigrant Equality. That's a lot of advocacy at UNC and awareness on what it means to be undocumented and immigrant in North Carolina. And that's my main goal, put a face to the issue at UNC. At the time, there weren't that many undocumented students who were open about their status. And so when I came to UNC, I was really open about my status. And again, I wanted to humanize the issue. I think UNC is a really progressive community. And by humanizing the issue, by putting a face to the issue, I was hoping that, you know, I could help change the way that the conversation around immigration was. And hopefully it changes in the next few years.
And you were open about this before DACA, before the Deferred Action Program.
Yeah,
so your status really did make you vulnerable when you came out.
Yeah, yeah. So I came out maybe, I want to say 5 years ago. The main reason that I came out was because I realized that by saying you're publicly undocumented, you empower yourself. You take away the fear. A lot of us live in fear of, like, you know, what's going to happen to us if our families are separated, if immigration enforcement comes and takes our families away. That's a legitimate fear that a lot of us have. And by saying that you're publicly undocumented, you also put a face to the issue. People who would have never realized or have thought of you as undocumented, their perception changes as well. And then you also realize the community that you have behind you, supporting you. And I truly believe it's an empowering tool when you say you're undocumented and unafraid. It makes you more empowered, and that's something to be proud of.
Well, it seems to me it shines a light on two important aspects of the immigration picture. Number one, you talk about it empowering you.
Right.
You're now in a place where you've done it, so I can speak more openly. The worst is over. I've overcome the fear. The other side is you really point to the lack of leverage that people have who come to this country and work and really can't speak out against work conditions, labor conditions, their salary, all of the things that we think you should be able to negotiate in a free market. You really can't when you're under the gun like this and under this threat, and yet the economy has shown it really needs people to do this work. So tell us about your families coming to the U.S. from Guatemala. It began with your father in 92, if I'm right.
Correct. Yeah. So a year after I was born, my dad traveled around Guatemala selling clothing, and he eventually realized that he wasn't making that much income from that. And by then, at that time, it was six of us. I was the youngest at the time, and he couldn't fully support my family, and so he decided the only thing he could do was come to the U.S. because he doesn't have an education. He only went up until seventh grade. He realized that he wouldn't qualify for a visa. To get a visa to come to the U.S., it's really hard. Unless you're wealthy or unless you have a high education, the chances of you getting a visa are really, really slim. And so the only option that he had was to smuggle and, you know, cross the border illegally. And so he came in 1992. He lived in different places across the country, and he eventually settled in Siler City, North Carolina, because of the poultry plants. He wanted to see my mother, and I came with her because I was the youngest at the time. And so we also crossed the border. I remember the journey. I have some really vague memories. I remember being on a cattle train, and this was at night, and I could smell the cow manure. And also remember at one point, I believe this was probably the Mexican-U.S. border. We were crossing under barbed wire, and one of the ladies that was with us, her hair got caught in underneath the barbed wire, and I can faintly hear her kind of, like, you know, being a little bit scared and screaming out loud. And so we eventually came to Siler City, and it was an exciting moment for me because I hadn't seen my father since basically the age of one, and obviously I can't recall anything from the age of one. And so I saw this whole journey of coming to the U.S. as an adventure to see my father.
And you were about 6 years old?
I was six.
So you went to kindergarten. You didn't speak Spanish. You speak Quiche.
Quiche.
So what was that like going to and not even having fellow Spanish speaking students?
Yeah, no, it's I've been thinking about it, and honestly, it was the transition wasn't that hard because I was six, and it was easy for me to adjust culturally and also learning the language. I was in ESL classes my first few years learning Spanish and English, and I was able to place out of ESL classes, and I was put into the honors gifted classes, and I've been in those classes since. And I think my mom had a harder time adjusting because she mostly spoke Quiche back in Guatemala, and at the same time she learned Spanish and some English here. And I have to say that she's definitely the smartest person that I know. She's an incredible woman who's been able to keep our family together.
We will hear more about that incredible woman and her incredible son as we continue our conversation with Emilio Vicente, a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. You'll hear about that on the State of Things from North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Please stay with us. This is the State of Things, broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stacio, talking with Emilio Vicente. Emilio is a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, recently a candidate for student body president. He lost that race. He is here today. He's a junior and a public policy student. We're talking about your earliest days in Siler City, and you talked about doing well in school. Your father had an accident, though. He started out in the poultry plant, but then got a job in the lumber industry, right?
Right. Yeah. So he had a lot of other jobs in between then. And all of these jobs were minimum wage jobs. And he wanted to find another job where he can make more income to support my family. And so he eventually decided to work at this lumber company really close by Siler City. And unfortunately, a couple of months into that new job, he had an accident at work. This machine fell on his back. It broke his spinal cord. And he's been paralyzed since then. This was 2001. And unfortunately, this changed dramatically the way that our family lived. I think it kind of also made me realize and appreciate a lot of the things that I had never really appreciated before. I lived with someone who was in a wheelchair. And that was a really hard experience for my family. At the time, I was 11. And so I was the person who was interpreting and helping my dad a lot because I was the only one in my family who spoke English and who could help them out or whom they trusted.
Yeah, then you have to learn medical English, which is a whole other language.
Yeah, which I did.
Right? I mean, that's really tough to be in that position and realize the amount of responsibility you have. And for your father, in addition to the pain and the difficulty of having to be in a wheelchair, the pain of knowing he can no longer really provide for his family.
Yeah, no, it was really hard on us, and even more because he was undocumented, and the legalities of everything, and he didn't have Social Security, and so we eventually learned how to adjust to all of the changes, and it was definitely by far one of the hardest experiences my family had. And I want to say that we've learned to overcome that challenge.
Eventually, he decided to go back. Tell us about that decision.
Yeah. So after his accident, he's always been in pain, and he still is, unfortunately, still in pain. And so there were moments where he felt that there was a good chance that he was going to die. And he wanted to see his mother, my grandmother. He wanted to, you know, see her in person if anything were to happen to him or to her. And so he eventually decided because of the accident, he actually had an order of deportation. Then he had tried fixing his immigration status before my family, before me and my mom came to the U.S. Unfortunately, it didn't work out, and he was given an automatic deportation order. The language barrier, a lot of other things basically piled on, and he decided to go back to Guatemala, see my grandmother, and he felt that maybe he would get better treatment there. And they gave me the option if I wanted to go or not, and this was a really hard decision for me, but I honestly appreciate that they made this an option. I eventually decided to stay because I felt that if I stayed here, I might have a better future. I didn't know that at the time, but my goal was I want to make my family proud. If I can, I want to go to college. And this was my freshman year in high school. And even then, I still didn't know the process of how to go to apply to college, how to be competitive. I just knew that I was doing academically well. And so I was just really optimistic that maybe if I did everything right, that maybe some university would want me as a student at their university. And so I stayed with my oldest brother, and I haven't seen them. It's actually been over 7 years now.
And they're back in Guatemala. And how is your grandmother?
She's doing as well as can be. She's older now. She physically is not as mobile. But I think my parents and her appreciate that they're all together. Hopefully I get to see her at some point in the next few years.
How are your mom and dad doing? Is he getting care?
They're doing as well as can be. They have a little small store. That's how they sustain themselves in Guatemala. Unfortunately, he's always in pain. It's something that he will never probably get rid of because that's how intense the accident was. My mom is doing okay. I think she definitely enjoys being back and being able to see her siblings. My brother and sister, whom she hadn't seen since she had lived here. So they're doing as well as can be.
So you stayed with your brother. You did very well in high school. And then tell us how you got into UNC Chapel Hill.
Yeah, so I want to say it was a mixture of luck and doing well. I had applied to many different schools. UNC had always been my dream school. I love this university. I went through a program called the Scholars Latino Initiative, a mentoring program that was based here in Siler City, based here at UNC Chapel Hill, with a partnership at Jordan Matthews High School where I went. I had a different experience that maybe UNC could benefit from. And I eventually received a private scholarship that allowed me to attend UNC. As an undocumented student, I don't qualify for any state or federal-based aid. And I'm technically an international student, regardless of the fact that I've lived here for over 15 years. Some people say, well, you're displacing a U.S. citizen. You're displacing a North Carolinian because you got accepted and they didn't. That's totally not the case at all. I went through the international process when I applied to UNC, and so no U.S. citizen was ever displaced because of me. And I think it's something that I really care about. We should make education more accessible to all students, especially undocumented students who are doing well. I want to say that a lot of it was luck because I'm pretty sure that there's probably someone out there who was definitely smarter than I can ever be, who could have also received the scholarship that I received, and I might not be at UNC.
But while you went through the process that every international student had to go through, if you had not gotten the scholarship, it would have been a $30,000 a year investment for you, and that would have been out of the question.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, my parents and I had this discussion, and with my brother as well, that they were like, you know, we want you to go as far as you can, but unfortunately, we don't have the money to pay for your education. And so I knew that. I knew that as I was going into my senior year, that there was a good chance that I wasn't going to be going to college because my family can't afford $30,000 a year. If they could afford that amount of money, then I probably wouldn't be undocumented in the first place. And so I definitely tried my best to stand out academically and also overall in my extracurricular activities.
And the experience you brought was a rich one. You were in Siler City when David Duke was there with his KKK rally and his anti-immigrant. Tell us about that and that experience for you.
Yeah, so I was really young at the time when this happened. And honestly, I don't really recall it because I was still in elementary school when this happened. But just going back a couple of I have been reading back more about Siler City, and I realized that this had happened. So Siler City is a good example of what's happened in the South. A lot of it happened during the time that me and my mom came to Siler City. There were a lot of different small towns across the South that immigrants were moving into, and because of poultry plants, because of farming, all of these industries that reaped off the labor of undocumented immigrants. And so Siler City was that prime example. And so David Duke, who was at the time the leader of the KKK, wanted to protest what was happening in the South. And so he came to Siler City and was basically telling the people that lived in Siler City to stand up against this change because it was bad for the country, it was bad for North Carolina, and it was bad for Siler City. And I think even now, when I go back, it's dramatically changed. My graduating class was 40% Latino. I want to say that's also around the same percent of the Latino population in Siler City. It's a really diverse, small town in the South.
So you have that experience, and then you come to UNC and you decide to come out about your status and also about your sexual orientation. Right. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So I didn't come out about my sexual orientation until last summer. It was something that I could have never done in Siler City. It's still a predominantly conservative town. In some ways it is open about welcoming undocumented immigrants because I think they realize that immigrants are the reason that Siler City is still alive and somewhat thriving. In terms of everything else, it's socially conservative, and so I remember even in high school at one point, one student wanted to start a gay straight alliance organization, and a lot of students were against it because they were like, you know, this is wrong, this is bad, this doesn't make sense. I remember that. And so in high school, I would have never said I was gay, but I knew that I was. And it wasn't until I came to UNC and a couple of years into my years that I was more comfortable with saying I was gay, and that was actually last summer that I publicly came out as gay.
What about your parents? What'd they say?
I think they're still learning. They're still learning. I want to say that my family is socially conservative as well. But I think at the end of the day, they realize that this is like, you know, this is who I am, and I think they'll eventually come around to, you know, fully embracing that.
I want to talk about the various comfort levels because we talked briefly about the mentoring program that allowed you to get in and get a scholarship to UNC Chapel Hill. And that had to do with being mentored by a fellow Latino student, right? So tell us about that. And again, this comfort level, this being able to come to UNC and come out about your orientation, what it means to see people like you, to be around people who look like you and sound like you, to be able to thrive.
Right. So the Scholar Latino Initiative was founded by a professor, former professor here at UNC called Peter Kaufman. He had actually was on the road one day, and he heard about the statistics of how a lot of Latino students were not going to college, and that a lot of them were at the same time were also doing really well academically. And so he got in contact with Paul Cuadros, who's also a professor at UNC, and they created this program where a sophomore high school student would be partnered with a sophomore UNC student, not necessarily Latino. It could be any race. The main emphasis was creating a 3-year partnership commitment of from sophomore year until we both graduate. You have this relationship, and through that, you would be informed of the process of how to apply to college, how to be competitive. And so, I want to say that by far, if it wasn't for this program, I probably wouldn't be at UNC. Again, I was doing well academically, but at the time, I didn't know what SATs were. I didn't even know there's such a thing as a GPA. All of the process of being competitive to go to a good school. And so through this program, I was empowered to know all of the right tools. And my mentor was definitely really influential. He was really involved on campus. And he was actually the first Latino college student I'd ever met in my life, and so that in itself was a really cool experience. I was like that I'd met someone who had made it this far along the way, and he definitely is an inspiration. And I'm actually mentoring a high school student myself right now. It's a really enriching and amazing experience to see to have been a mentee and now be a mentor for someone else. And I hope to continue supporting the program, you know, hopefully later on in life.
These two experiences similar in any way? They would seem to be, but perhaps not. That coming out as undocumented and coming out as gay, did one lead to the other? Was it at all helpful to have talked about your status first?
Yeah. I want to say that they definitely, being undocumented helped me to embrace my full identity of also being gay. So I mentioned how it was really empowering for me to say I'm undocumented and unafraid. And so that made me realize that if I wanna fully embrace who I am, I have to also acknowledge parts of me that I haven't made public. And so that was, for me, that was my sexual orientation. And even just looking at the level of engagement at the national level, it's really interesting to see that some of the most prominent and activists on immigration are also happen to be gay. There's José Antonio Vargas, who's probably the most prominent example. He's the most well-known activist, and he's undocumented and gay. And his story is really interesting because he came out first as gay, and then he came out later on as undocumented, whereas my experience was different. And I came out first as undocumented and then gay. And we're actually really good friends. And we definitely talked during this campaign process, and he gave me some advice on what to do. But I do think that it definitely empowered me to first come out as undocumented and then gay. It was easier for me to come out as gay because everyone in my family knew we were all undocumented. It was not a secret at all, and so there was that comfort. And once I did that, I met more students who were also gay and undocumented, and it just made me feel more okay with saying I'm gay. And UNC again is an inclusive environment where it felt really comfortable for me to say I was gay, and I knew that there wasn't going to be any backlash or someone was going to say anything negative. Since I've come out, a lot of my friends have supported me, sent me messages and text messages supporting.
It's a real paradox, isn't it? I mean, on the one hand, your courage comes from facing down each of these vulnerabilities, vulnerable only because of social impressions about these various statuses. But each time it becomes another identity. For you, these merge and become one and
right.
give courage and conviction, the courage of your convictions. But then for the outside world looking in, there are these separate identities for which you must be the spokesman and the representative.
Right, right.
So that's the sort of other side of this now,
yeah.
right?
And that's so true. And I think, unfortunately, that played out in this election for student body president. When I ran for student body president, I didn't say, oh, I'm gay and undocumented and I'm Latino, and those are going to be the main identities that I'm going to run on. I had a platform. I had a vision of what I wanted to see the university go. And because of the media attention, I think the media attention focused more on my different identities. And I know that one of the criticisms that I got from this campaign was that I'm only doing this to boost my resume to get national attention, which is never the case. And unfortunately, I think that if someone steps out of the mainstream, if someone steps out of who usually runs for student body president at any university, those identities stand out the most. And it's unfortunate that it's like you only see someone as these three different identities as opposed to what they have of what they want to see the university winning for.
Well, you got to know that those three are going to get you on public radio right away. There's just no way you're going to miss this opportunity. But and we're happy to talk with you. Let me ask you about this, because public
sure.
policy is your goal.
Right.
And you are bringing attention to this, I think, for all the right reasons. And part of your work was to go lobby Senator Kay Hagan about the
yeah.
DREAM Act. Didn't work, bless you, but you tried. Tell us about that.
Yeah. So this happened during my gap year. The reason that I took a gap year was because I was kind of burnt out from high school. I think I did okay, and I was like, I want to take a break and do something that I'm really passionate about. And this was sort of along the time that the DREAM Act, a bill that would have given undocumented students a pathway to citizenship, was being debated, and there was a good chance that it was going to pass. And so I moved to D.C. and I was lobbying Kay Hagan. I actually went to her. She has Carolina coffees every single Wednesday at 8 a.m. until I believe 9 a.m. When the Senate is in session. And so I heard about these, and I was like, oh, I want to go meet her and try to persuade her to vote for the DREAM Act once it came up for a vote. And so the first time around, she tried ignoring me. She didn't really want to have the conversation. And I stood around and I waited until I was the last person. And so she had to acknowledge me. And so she gave me the opportunity of sharing my story with her. And since then, I went to almost every single coffee that she had. And so I spoke directly with her. And I want to say that she recognizes who I am. She might not remember my name, but I'm definitely sure that she recognizes me. And so once the DREAM Act came out for a vote in December of 2010, she initially had voted yes at the beginning of the roll call, and towards the end voted against it. And I think I want to say that it was a really political move on her end. She knew that it was the right thing to do. I'm not a unique story. I think there are a lot of other stories across the state, similar students trying to get an education. And she knew that. And I've seen her a couple of times since then, and I'm happy that she voted for the immigration bill that came out last year, and hopefully immigration overall is addressed in the next few months.
I've got about 30 seconds left. What's next for you?
That's a good question. Honestly, I don't know yet. I'm embracing all of the free time that I've received. I can actually catch up on homework, sleep, and see my friends more often. I'm taking this one step at a time. Honestly, don't know what I'm going to do next, but I'm enjoying every moment that I have right now.
We will stay tuned. Emilio, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Emilio Vicente is a student at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Coming up next, former New York City ballet dancer reflects on her career in dance and her struggle with body image. Stay with us.